First of all, I want to thank any visitors that we have for coming this afternoon. As mentioned, George, our regular minister, is up in Dumas holding the meeting, and he passed the speaking baton to us scrubs, at least this afternoon. But anyway, I want to thank the elders for the opportunity to speak to you, for their confidence in you, that I can stand up here and say something that will edify the brethren and be a spiritual uplift to you, but also at the same time that bring honor and glory to our Heavenly Father. I'm going to give a talk this afternoon on weather statements in the Bible and how accurate they were. I hope that you'll find my lesson on meteorology in the Bible interesting. All you young people, listen to me for a minute. You're going to hear me say something about weather being God's creation that you will never hear in school or on TV or in the higher educational institutions of the land, who all are trying to distance themselves from God. Remember, you are a creationist. It's the same as saying that you believe that God created this universe in exactly the same manner that is described in Genesis. That in 6 days he created the heavens and the earth, and that God rested on the seventh day. The purpose of my lesson is to convince you that God and the Holy Spirit authored the Bible, and that all the scriptures are God-breathed and came to man through inspired writers. All of nature and what you see outside is his handiwork. His natural laws are in effect. He put in place at the beginning and are still in effect today, whether man understands it or not. The heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork, or the layers between shows his handiwork. God has it all under his control. We will see that his natural laws control the thermodynamics of the atmosphere or the weather. Some of you know that I'm a retired meteorologist. I worked for NOAA for 37 years. I got my academic qualifications for a meteorologist at UT back in the 60s, and that's when my kids were little. I know they think that was a long time ago or ages ago, but my grandkids think I'm probably as old as Methuselah. But I did bring the first anemometer across the west of the Mississippi. I got a picture of that, I think. I'm not in my comfort zone up here with this, but I want to thank David for setting this up. I hope this comes out like this. I brought my graphics over that I could use, the overhead that I used for years, but I hope this all, that David fixed this up good. I'm sure he did. But here's my covered wagon that I reported the first wind speed in Texas out of. But anyway, through the years as I read my Bible, being a meteorologist, I kept reading statements in the Bible that would ring a bell to me, as if to say, you know, this could mean this, or it could mean that. Let me ask you something. In their primitive knowledge of science, how could Job, or the writer of Job, and David, and Moses, or Solomon make statements like this? The sea has passed, the wind comes again on a circuit, or air has weight, or the wind comes again on a circuit. I just mentioned that. It is clear the Bible's authors, in most cases, had no idea of the full meaning of what their statements meant or what they were revealing. Remember that the Bible is not written as a science book, as Ken Bonin so did real well in his lesson this morning on absolute truth. Not written as a science book, but it is scientifically accurate. God is concerned about the spiritual or the inner man, not the issues of science, nor the ignorance of man's ignorance of the same. God says this to us, you want to learn nature, then listen and look to the heavens. Look at my handiwork, the birds, the animal life, the beauty and design of nature, what I've made. Note these two passages of Scripture, Job 12, 7 through 9, and Psalms 19, 1 and 2. It says, in the vast expanse of the heavens, and his handiwork, meaning the earth and nature, that it speaks to us, reveals knowledge day unto day and night unto night. We are to be impressed with what we see, and we are to search him out. And that's Romans 1 and 20. As you came in here this afternoon, you probably picked up a list of phrases, meteorological phrases. Did everyone get one? Scott was going to get some out if somebody missed one. Okay? As you came in, you were handed a list of phrases that I'm going to go over. I've got 10 graphics that I'm going to show. And most of the statements are sharp and concise. But that does not take away from their accuracy. Since when does brevity equal inaccuracy? If we take that premise on subjects, we're on mighty weak ground. Just because God says something brief, that doesn't mean it's not accurate. It's not written. I mean, he didn't write it to explain all the weather statements that are in the Bible. God never intended for these statements to represent a detailed explanation of science. The statements or word listed are consistent, do not contradict the present-day meteorological knowledge. They were mentioned in the Bible thousands of years before they were discovered by man. If we examine these statements with present-day laws of nature and find them to be accurate, we have a powerful and convincing evidence of divine authorship of the Bible. My talk by no means includes all the weather statements or summarization of weather events in the Bible. As a matter of fact, I've left off some very interesting ones, like the east winds that blew off of Saudi Arabia and dried out the bottom of the Red Sea before the Israelites crossed over the night before. It says a hot east wind dried out the bottom of the Red Sea. And also, I don't mention anything about Noah and the flood, and the 40 days and 40 nights, or where the fountains of the deep erupted. I can't give an explanation of these phrases without going into some technical terminology of meteorology. So I've made 10 graphics trying to explain what these words could mean from my perspective as being a meteorologist. There's one change on that list. Down at number 7, there's a listing down there for Psalms. It says 137.7. It should be 135.7. Okay, that's the last one. Okay, contact David. Let's look at the statement that David made in Psalms 8 and 8. My New King James Version says, the fish that pass through the paths of the sea. The Revised Standard Version says, whatever passes along the paths of the sea. It does not say paths in the sea. It's not mentioned in the Bible, but that David was ever on a sailing ship. In the mid-1800s, and Ken mentioned it this morning, but if we start eliminating from the pulpit everything that people have said previously, we wouldn't have much to talk about. Besides, Robert Turner used to say, tell everybody three times. You know, say it once, say it twice, say it three times. So there are two scriptures that I'll mention that Ken Bonin mentioned this morning. There was a well-known professor of mathematics and oceanography at VMI, Virginia Military Institute, named Matthew Murray. He was a devout creationist. He was the first American to chart the ocean bottoms and ocean currents. His navigational maps are still used, or was used for generations for sailors at sea. He was quoted in one of his books to make this scientific statement. I've always found in my scientific studies that when I could get the Bible to say anything on a subject, it afforded me a platform to stand on and a ladder to which I could safely ascend. He got his idea of ocean currents from the Bible. One time on a sickbed, his wife read him from the Bible, Psalms 8 and 8. Believing the Bible to be correct about these paths of the sea, he set out to find them. Dr. Murray was the first in recent times to discover that seas and the oceans had circulating systems with interactions between the two. In other words, the atmosphere moves around due to the different temperatures and also the fact that the earth is spinning, that this Coriolis force works on the water and the air. Actually, the air behaves in fluid flow just like the oceans do. It's just a different density. Anyway, he was the first one to discover the interaction between the two. While he was not the first one to believe the oceans had currents, he was the first one to chart them. In the 1700s, sailing ships sailing from England to New World discovered that it took 2 weeks longer to go to the New America than the return trip. They were unaware of the strong Gulf Stream that goes up the east coast and crosses near Labrador and goes up toward England. And it was later discovered that this Gulf Stream had a flow rate equal to the flow rate of the Mississippi and Amazon River. In other words, it flowed 4 to 6 miles an hour. It was once thought that air was weightless. Yet 4,000 years ago, the writer of Job made a statement. God established a weight for the wind. I used to give hundreds of talks to schools and classes, and I would tell them to understand whether you have to understand that air has weight. 50 miles of the Earth's atmosphere is exerting a force downward due to gravity. The laws of gravity apply to all existing matter near the surface of the Earth, including the air we breathe. Just a simple illustration of this: if air were not heavy, how could an airplane fly? Or how could a thunderstorm hold up a hailstorm the size of a softball? Meteorologists in recent years have calculated the average thunderstorm holds tons of rain. It's hard to visualize this, but a column of air 50 miles high is pressing down on your head. It was once thought that the air was weightless. But 300 years ago, this is 300 years from now back, there was an Italian physicist named Torricelli who invented the barometer to measure the weight of the atmosphere or atmospheric pressure. Did the Bible say that the air had weight long before this? Job 28:25. And I'm not going to go to all those scriptures because we won't have time to go through all this. Job 28:25 says, to make a weight for the wind. Your version might say force, but you can't separate the two. Air moves on the earth's surface due mainly to different densities or the temperature differential, which is the same thing as saying the different weights or different atmospheric pressures. Air is moving because of different weights. Visualize this. A surface that is one... I'll leave it up here. Let's see. A surface that is 1 square inch that on the Earth's surface, a column of air going right straight up weighs 15 pounds. That's what that column of air will weigh. That's hard for us to visualize that, but that's true. Job 10:13 says this. The third one down on the list is, your version may say treasures. I'm sorry. The term is wind out of the storehouses. This term is found in several locations. The one in Jeremiah 10:13 says, look at the context carefully. You see that all of the other subjects are real and tangible out of that context there. There is nothing that suggests that forces associated with wind are mysterious or just because we can't see them. The storehouses or treasuries could be nothing more than atmospheric pressure centers. Pressure centers exist because the sun doesn't unequally heat the Earth's surface. I'll say that 2 or 3 times. The unequal heating creates density, atmospheric pressure centers, because of the density and different weights. The Earth's in a constant turmoil, trying at all times to equalize the temperature, but it never makes it because the sun unequally heats the surface. Earth's surface every day. If all we had was a pressure gradient force, the wind would blow directly from high pressure to low pressure. Then we'd go right straight across here. There's several factors or forces working on the partial air. The strongest one is the pressure gradient. The next one is Coriolis force, which turns everything that's moving in the northern hemisphere to the right. So air really circulates around high pressure like this. It tries to go like this, turns the wind to the right. friction, the friction involved too. But we have other forces like friction. So the air is turned to the right, and the resultant vector is almost parallel to the lines of equal pressure, like this. We do not have hurricanes or typhoons within 10 degrees north or 10 degrees south of the equator because Coriolis force is zero around the equator. Pressure differences, the low pressure systems quickly fill up. High pressure moves in right quick and fills it up because there's no Coriolis force at the equator. We'll look at the wind in the circle this minute. And Ken mentioned this morning, but this is an interesting verse over in Ecclesiastes. Solomon said, all rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. This gives us a real good description of a vital hydrological cycle. Without it, man and life could not exist. One modern day version says this, and I don't like to use these, because these modern day versions, because a lot of them are just commentary rather than an actual accurate translation. But anyway, one of them says this: he pulls water up out of the sea, rising vapors, distills it, and fills up rain cloud systems, and then the sky opens up and pours out soaking showers on everyone. That's exactly what happened with the King James Version of Charter. We have the oceans. We have evaporation. We have water vapor transport that goes over land. Showers form. They fall into the lake. Rivers run. There is some seepage into the underground. And you have even underground flow that goes into the ocean. Probably so vice versa, too. The sea breezes... bring in water vapor from the ocean. And by the way, it wouldn't hurt to read Job. I've got that down to read Job 36, 27 to 28. Let's read. I'll read that right quick. Job, most of these verses are in Job, so just keep your finger in Job. Job 36, 27 to 28. For he draws up water, for he draws up drops of water, which distilled as rain from the mist, which the clouds drop down and pour abundantly on man. Job 28, 25, and 26 makes a simple statement that is a broad application in meteorology. It says there, he made a decree or law for the rain. It could certainly mean in a broad sense, like the hydrological cycle that we just saw, but it also could mean the formation of rain obeys the physical laws of the atmosphere. God thermally constructed the atmosphere such that air would rise and water vapor would condense into rain. The gases of the atmosphere are 78% oxygen, 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, and 1% water vapor, and there's traces amount, less than 1% of ozone, argon, and carbon dioxide. But rising water vapors are mentioned a few times in the Old Testament when the subject is weather. Water vapor rises because of changes in temperature, cooling and height. Here we see from this diagram that as you go up in the atmosphere, air, if you take a partial of air, what happened here? There it is. As you go up in the atmosphere and cool a partial air, take a partial air, you start raising or going aloft with it. It cools at 3.5 degrees Fahrenheit for every 1,000 feet you go up to. You get to about 40,000 feet, and then the layer becomes isothermal. It doesn't get any colder anymore. It doesn't get any colder than -76 degrees Fahrenheit. That's an average. And that point right there controls the storms. We get thunderstorms form, and they hit the tropopause. That's God's barrier to keep the storm from getting out of hand. You think, well, they get out of hand anyway. They could be a whole lot worse than what they are. thunderstorm, the lightning bolt in North Pole because the air is too compressed. The trumpet calls is lower, 30,000 foot lower. But anyways, you can see that if you go on up above 50,000, it actually starts warning just a little bit. In other words, God fixed my limit for the clouds. When that, you took, look at 38, 9, and 10, it's talking about the clouds, but also it's mentioned right before that about the seas. He's got control and laws for the seas, too, that obey his limits, laws and limits. Okay, we learned that tropopause inhibits storm growth. For a storm to break through that inversion, it has to have severe updrafts and tremendous buoyancy. Job 38, 9 and 10 says he's fixed a limit for the clouds. And in Job 26, 12 says that by his understanding, he breaks up the storm. That's a good verse to read. Job 26, 12 says that by his understanding, he breaks up the clouds, breaks up the storm. Astronomers tell us that the atmosphere of some of the planets have violent storms with winds reaching 1,000 miles an hour. So we live in an atmosphere that God is controlling. Don't think that storms can't be any worse than they are, because they can. Here's a picture of a material thunderstorm. There are some descriptive terms in the scriptures that apply to thunderstorms. As already mentioned, rising or ascending water vapors has a broad application in meteorology. And you find that term many times in the Bible, ascending or rising water vapors. But it has a broad application in meteorology, including thunderstorm. Water vapors are brought into the base of the thunderstorm by low-level winds. And as air rises within the thunderstorm, water vapor condenses into rain, is carried high in high altitude where it freezes and forms hail. And in Job 38:2, God asked Job, "Have you seen the treasury or storehouse of hail?" Asking Job, "Do you understand how hail is made?" He asked Job that. And I'm going to go into that, but that, the red here indicates where the hail, where God's hail storehouse is. In other words, you got uphole coming, you hit some of these updrafts reach 100 miles an hour, which will support it. A large hailstone. They fall, they get caught in the updraft, and it's not uncommon to cut a hailstone in two, and you see concentric circles like tree circles, like you do on the trunk of a tree, or when you slice an onion in two, you see all these rings. That's how many times the hail is going through the thunderstorm. And until it gets heavy enough that it falls through the updraft and comes over down the ground. And wherever there's a wind velocity reaching 100 miles an hour to support hail like that, there's a corresponding downdraft that equals the velocity of the updraft, and you have a downburst that equal to 100 miles an hour and the velocity of the updraft. But anyway, let's see. The heavy rain produced by the rising water vapors causes unequal distribution of the electrical charges in the cloud that produces lightning. There's only one scripture in the Bible that contains all three of these words. And it's got water vapors, and then it mentions rain, lightning, and thunder. And they're all in the proper sequence in Job 28 and 26. There's other scriptures that mention rain and hail and thunder individually, but when they're all mentioned, they're all mentioned in the proper sequence. In other words, you have water vapor first, rain. Rain separates the electrical charges. You have lightning, and then you have thunder. We see God's barrier up here in the tropopause that limits the growth. See the tropopause right here? This thunderstorm builds up, and it spreads out. And in Job 36:29, we read about God's canopy. He says something about the thunderstorm, God's canopy. That's the canopy, and it's tropopause. That's what those things build up, and it's a warming level, and then starts spreading out. The jet stream blows across here like that, and sometimes it blows the canopy hundreds of miles up from the thunderstorm. And here we have what we call the overshooting top, where these severe updrafts, it busts out through that inversion, and we used to measure that with radar all the time, and we could see the severity of the storm depends on how high the tropopause is above, because we know that it wouldn't be that high unless it was severe. Let's talk briefly.
See, that, everything about the thunder going on.
Okay. Let's talk briefly, just a second, about nature's biggest storm, the hurricane. And there's nothing in the scriptures that, except this verse, except rising water vapors about the hurricane. Not until the last 100 years have meteorologists understood how the hurricane got its energy. It's a complicated system or circulation, but the energy comes from rising water vapors. Tropical rains fall within the system, giving off heat to great heights of the atmosphere, and the hurricane is one giant heat machine. As it moves northward away from the tropics, it's nature's way of transferring the heat from the equatorial regions toward the poles. It's that simple. So in conclusion of this graphic, let's say that rising water vapors give birth to nature's biggest storm, the hurricane or typhoon and the thunderstorm. Come on, get through.
Okay.
Ecclesiastes 1 and 6 speaks of the wind being on a circuit. Let's read this verse. The wind goes toward the south and turns toward the north. The wind whirls about continuously and comes again on a circuit. Nearly all versions use the word circuit. The upper jet stream is a good application of this verse. As we've already learned, the general circulation of the atmosphere is in a constant motion trying to equalize the temperature, but it never makes it because the sun unequal heats our surface every day. Pressure maps are drawn at different levels in the atmosphere to see what's going on at a deep level. You get up around 20,000 feet, there's a fast moving column stream of air we call a jet stream that sometimes has speeds of 150 to 200 miles an hour. This graphic shows the northern hemisphere viewed from out in space over the North Pole. In other words, here's the North Pole and we're way out in space. Usually when you see a graphic like this of a globe, you never see one like this. In other words, this thing right here is the equator. You're seeing all the northern half of the hemisphere, but there is this jet stream, flow of fast moving air that circles the globe like that. And there's usually five kinks of these all the way around the globe, and they slowly rotate like a wagon wheel. Sometimes they get locked in place and they won't move for a month, about 2-3 weeks. But they're all connected. And if there's ever in meteorology a description of a wind on a circuit, this jet stream. Now I could do the same thing for a surface map that showed you how they all happened, but this jet stream is a good explanation of the wind in a circuit. Okay. Our God is our sun, S-U-N, and shield. Those words are in Psalms 84:11. These words were not in the weather context, even though rain was mentioned up in verse 6. The words here mean God is our dwelling place and protector. But I can say that God is our sun and shield and make a truthful statement with respect to the atmosphere and sun. God, after all, is the sun. He's the sustainer of life and a shield. He structured a protective covering or shield over us. We're in the hollow of his hand. We're in his care. He looks after us. He's got the whole weather controlled so that we can live here. The words in the Bible are not outlawed by God in our vocabulary if we make a truthful statement about the words. So I can say God is our sun and shield, and that's a truthful statement. Let's look at the barriers and shields placed in our atmosphere by God so that life can be maintained. First, you see the tropopause, where storms do not break through. That's a barrier.
And that's the red right here. There's Mount Everest. You can see the tropopause is 5 to 7 miles high. That represents the red right there. Got airplanes fly right below that, about 40,000 feet. Got thunderstorms that build and
sometimes break it. The sun emits radiation in all wavelengths. The Earth's atmosphere reflects out into space about 40% of all the sun's radiations. If it didn't do that, the Earth would get too hot. 100-mile thickness of heavy air causes friction to fast-moving objects, and comets, meteorites, and asteroids are burned up. In other words, the
90% of the atmosphere, 99% of the atmosphere is below 50 miles. This line here represents 50 miles. And 99% of the atmosphere is below the ionosphere. And you're not, NASA doesn't consider that you're out in outer space until you get to 100 miles up. But yet above 50 to 100,000 feet, there's only 1% of the atmosphere, and it's lighter. But you're not out in outer space until you get to 100 miles up.
And I've already mentioned about Earth's atmosphere and the gases, 78% nitrogen, 21% oxygen, 1% water vapor. Less than 1% of the air is ozone. But 90% of the Earth ozone is in a layer just above the troposphere.
The ozone layer is right here, right above the troposphere. It's a blue wagon line, and they go all the way around the Earth.
And it's from 8 to 20 miles high. The ozone layer absorbs and reflects the radiation from the sun in the deadly range of the ultraviolet, the gamma rays, and the X-rays. Also, there's some reflection of the infrared radiation or heat rays from the sun over here.
We don't want too much radiation in the heat range. That's called infrared over here because we want some of it to go back out. And
so there's a balance there to be maintained so that the loss of heat from the sun's radiation from the Earth will not, so that we won't have global warming. The last shield that I'll mention on this graphic is the ionosphere, which reflects and absorbs the solar wind, which is made up of some nuclear radiation, and that reflection is due mainly to the Earth's magnetic field reflects that, and that's out over there. So we see from this graphic there is at least five shields God put in the atmosphere to protect us so that we could live here. The last one. Look, let's come over to the New Testament. Actually, these are not statements about weather, but I want to show you how accurate the wind directions were mentioned in Acts 27 about Paul's voyage to Rome. It's amazing when you start looking at the way the ship went and what's described in Acts. I listed some of those on that handout. But you can see Paul's ship left Caesarea of Israel on the coast of Israel. He went to Sidon. There's Cyprus right here. They sailed on the south coast of Asia. They went down on the south. I'm going over part of my thing here. Let me see. I don't want to get ahead of myself. It's apparent that the attempt to cross the Mediterranean Sea from the Caesarea on the coast of Israel west of Italy began in the late fall of the year because it mentions wintering 3 months in Malta and a fire that they kept to keep warm. They're not going to build a fire down on Padre Island during the summertime. That's about the same latitude. But anyway, this line represents the course of Paul's ship. Looking at the latitude of the Mediterranean, it is located 30 to 35 degrees north latitude. In the late fall, this would place the global prevailing western winds over the area and cause a storm track across the Mediterranean to be basically a west-east track, much like the Midwest is here during the wintertime. In some of the older narratives on record of sailing the Mediterranean, the sailing ships, it said that their sailing season ended in September as the strong westerlies usually swept across the sea this time of the year. Quickly, verse 4, it says, we sailed in the shelter of Cyprus, which would imply that they had a west or northwest wind.
They didn't head out across there. They got up here and they sailed in the shelter of Cyprus.
Verse 7, they sailed slowly on the south coast of Asia to Sindus, which would hint a northwest or west wind. They hugged the coast here, which would imply that they had some winds going, or northwest wind. Verse 8 says they had more difficult sailing, indicating a more headwind towards Crete, or a westerly component of the wind. And
when they got here,
Paul, in verse 9, Paul advises them not to go But they did, the only time during that voyage that they had light winds in verse 13, and it was the calm before the storm. Because as soon as they had the light winds, the next day, it says a northeasterner moved in and blew us south to an island named Claudia. Claudia is an island out down here. So the north wind blew them down there. And at verse 27, it says, after 14 days of tacking the wind, a series of tacks sailing against a headwind, this 500 miles from here to here, it took them 14 days. And most Bible scholars, when they draw a map of this, they wiggle this line like this, which means they were tacking the wind. They were going like that. They never, you know, you can't sail into a headwind. Not one time on the whole voyage did it say that they had favorable winds, except when they had stayed 3 months at Malta. It says in the springtime they sailed to Regium right here, and the south wind blew. Finally got a favorable wind, and they covered the last 200 miles in one day. That's what the scripture says. I tell you, that concludes my that's my last draft. I'll have to try it again. Oh, it's in there. Okay. The purpose of my talk, of course, was to give you Bible evidence that God had a hand in the writing of the Old Testament and the New, that the Scriptures were inspired. I think it's very apparent that this was the case. In the New Testament, we read of a church that Jesus said he was going to build in Matthew 16 and 18. And it also is apparent from the Scriptures in the book of Acts. It tells us how the Lord added individuals to his church. In 2 Corinthians 11 and 2, in Revelation 21 and 9, the church is spoken of as being the bride of Christ. Christ is coming back for his bride someday. In the Old Testament, the children of Israel were spoken of as being betrothed to God. Hosea 3:19. And God is the husband of his people. Isaiah 54:5 and Jeremiah 3:14. In all the conversions listed in the New Testament, here's what the people did that were added to the church. They either read or heard the gospel. They believed what they read. They repented of their sins. They confessed that they believed Jesus was the Son of God. All converted people were baptized for the remission of their sins. Then they were added to the church or to the saved. And of course, last, they have to live a faithful life unto death. A person can do the same thing today, very simple step, to be added to the Lord's church. If you're subject to the invitation, would you come on and stand and sing?